blog post earlier today, or I guess, yeah, late last night, early this morning. Stephen's going to be talking to us about open ed resources potentially here tonight, maybe models thereof, edupunks and what an edupunk is, do-it-yourself courses, programs, universities potentially, maybe touch on educational blogging and personalized learning environments. But Stephen can talk about anything he wants to. He's interested in online learning or e-learning, Web 2.0, the syndication of content thereof, and new media, emerging media like the iPad this week. As I mentioned, I met Stephen in Toronto on November 8th, 2000, to be exact. I showed up a day early, and they had moved our talk date to the following day. I showed up on November 7th in the room to present, and nobody else was there. And I was wondering, what's going on here? And they had conveniently posted it on the website but never sent an email to the presenters. We were supposed to go to the website and figure that out. And so that following day was election day in the U.S., and I got a little upset saying, hey, I've got to go back and vote. And I made the Telelearning Centers of Excellence pay for my extended stay, my change in flight, my taxi ride to the consulate, my taxi ride back, the FedEx shipment overnight. It cost them $400 to get me to vote, maybe more than that, but it was some vote. Actually, it didn't count too well here in Indiana, but I tried. So that was a day that Stephen and I think Ron Osten and I and others from Waterloo were presenting on all that was happening in the world of e-learning and the web and linking it to the diffusion model, diffusion innovation model of Everett Rogers, and looking at the cycles in which most technologies are adapted or not adapted, and where we were at the time. And Stephen had a brilliant presentation. I didn't, but he did. So I don't know what happened there, but we just got blown up. So maybe I should sit on a book again so I look a little taller than Stephen. There we go. I'm going to stop talking now.
Oh, you meant that literally. Kurt, you still there? Kurt is frozen. Okay, that's pretty interesting, Kurt. I don't know if anyone else can hear me, but you are completely frozen. No voice, no video. But we still have other people in the room, so I'm just going to take it over from there as though Kurt had actually stopped talking, and go ahead with my talk. And it appears that my cat is going to join me. well, that makes life interesting. Hang on, I'm just going to put this on lock and plug in my earphones. There we go. So here's my cat. There you are, Alex. This is Alex, and now Alex is being broadcast around the world.
You toss me the pointer.
He's one of the world's most famous cats. And here's, I've always wanted to do this. I'm sorry, I'm just having a little fun before I start because it's been a long week. No. You will be assimilated.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I just tossed the laser pointer to Andrea, and she will lure the cat off the desk. So, okay. Things happen, and I don't know that they're happening, but that's all right. Obviously, we have people helping behind the scenes here, and I'll take this as a hint to start the talk. Look, I've been involved in a bunch of arguments recently around open education, open educational resources, do-it-yourself, and all of that. And I had promised myself I would get started on Anya's book, but I haven't. I just did a quick look at it, but I got kind of a gist. And I've got a bunch of things going on. So this is where a lot of this presentation is born, but it's also born in Kurt's very, very generous introduction of me in his blog post. And one of the things he did in his blog post is he restated a quote that I have on my website. Please do not adjust the screen. It affects us all. We don't know why it affects us all, but it does. There must be some way of locking that. Oh, well, I'm not going to worry about that. It's quite funny. You remember when you said the words, "I am going to stop talking"? At that exact moment, you froze.
Okay.
So,
thanks again for coming here tonight. See, I did say thank yous. Okay, I'll type out.
Okay, so I'm just going to continue where I was then and plug in my headphones again so that I don't get echo if somebody talks. Although, actually, the echo cancellation seemed to work pretty well, so maybe I'll go without that. And if I need it later, I'll use it. But for now, I'll just go without earphones and wild and free. So, and it's evident from his introduction, very interesting. Like, Kurt hasn't seen the slides yet because he came in at the last minute and jumped into his seat and said, "Okay, I'll introduce Steve," without really knowing what he's talking about. So Kurt put this quote in the post advertising, and we'll all mourn the fact that we've all been demoted. I'm sorry, I'm just kidding. It's a funny thing. This is an aside. It's a funny thing. One of the reasons why I don't do presentations far in advance, and I'm sure you'll be able to identify with this, Kurt, is that my mood is different if I prepare the slides ahead of time and then give the presentation. And that really confuses me because I don't always know what I meant. And it's a funny thing. Half an hour, well, no, actually it's about 2 hours ago when I started preparing my slides, I was in one mood. But then, now I'm in a different mood. So, if only I could be preparing the slides as I'm doing this. Anyhow, I'm wasted too much time. I don't want to waste people's time. It's important not to. All right, let me begin with the quote, because this is important. And this has been on my website with one word misspelled for the last 7 or 8 years. It's been a very long time. And the origin of the quote, it's buried in an interview. Somebody did an interview with me, and it's just something I said in the middle of the interview. Actually, I typed it. It was an email interview. And later on, I realized, yeah, that captures what I mean. So what I wrote and what's been on my website since: I want to visualize and aspire toward a system of society and learning where each person is able to rise to his or her fullest potential without social or financial encumbrance, where they may express themselves fully and without reservation through art, writing, athletics, invention, or even through their avocations or lifestyle, where they are able to form networks of meaningful and rewarding relationships with their peers, with people who share the same interests or hobbies, the same political or religious affiliations, or different interests and affiliations, as the case may be. This, to me, is a society where knowledge and learning are public goods freely created and shared, not hoarded or withheld in order to extract wealth or influence. This is what I aspire to. This is what I work toward. So I reread that when I read Kurt's introduction, and I realized, okay, well, this is a talk about open educational resources and who knows what. And I had a bunch of things that I wanted to say, which turned out to be postscripts to this talk. And as I read the talk itself, I realized this is my talk. So let's examine the quote. Because the things that I want to say about open educational resources are in the quote. So what do I mean when I say the different parts of this quote? Well, let's look at the first bit. I want to visualize and aspire toward a system of society and learning. And yes, it's a vision statement, and I'm on record elsewhere as hating vision statements. But it's a personal vision statement, not a corporate vision statement, and that's very important. This expresses my attitude, my approach the thing that I am doing with my work and indeed a large part of my life. It's also a part of my own program of learning. Me doing this, putting this out there on the web, is me demonstrating something that I think is important, and I express that in the paper, Things You Really Need to Learn. The link is there. You'll find all kinds of links like that through this talk. Point number second last or last, the idea of living meaningfully. And one of the things that people need to do in order to live meaningfully is to live for some purpose, value, goal, or whatever. And it doesn't matter what it is. What matters is that you have one. And typically, almost exclusively, these are personal points. And I say in that paper, it's important for you to come up with your own vision of what's important and what matters to you, because if you don't, other people will do it for you. And that's the point where you begin to lose your freedom, where you begin to lose your identity. That's a theme that runs throughout the writing that I do. Another thing that's important in this first bit of the quote is that I believe that society and learning are not separate. Now, we separate them today. We take school children, we put them in boxes, separate them out from society, and so learning is something that's very distinct from the rest of living. And it's almost like we're teaching people that the rest of living isn't where we learn. You have to do special things in order to learn. And it's not the first time we've done this. We used to do this with reading, where we'd have special rooms for reading. And the only reading people did would be in the reading room. And they would have very special devices designed for reading. We called them books. And that was the only place where reading was done. But reading eventually became ubiquitous. It became something everybody could do. We had, national literacy programs. And one of the results of that is that reading and writing became available everywhere. I look around me, there's writing on a hat. Look, here's a hat, there's writing on it. Who would have thought? You know what I mean? If we get past the day where learning is something that we do in special little rooms, then instead of just writing on the hat, we'll have learning on the hat. And learning will inform our whole lives and not just, some segmented bit of it. So that's the start, that's the frame, a personal vision and the idea of society and learning being inextricably mixed together. So where am I taking this? Well, the next part is where each person is able to rise to his or her fullest potential. The Greeks called this arete, and you see the link to the Wikipedia page on that. And this is the idea that each individual has his or her, or it, because it applies to everything, not just people, own individual virtue. Now, it's tied to various aspects of Aristotelian philosophy that are not relevant, actually. But the main idea here is that each one of us has our own sort of excellence that we can rise to, our own sort of potential that we can fulfill. Sometimes people call this authentic living and all of that, but I don't want to get into the jargon. All I want to get into here is the idea that we each have our own individual way of achieving and being the best that we can be, rather than any sort of requirement or need or capacity or even ability to fulfill someone else's idea of excellence or virtue, etc. Now, and this really draws to me a strong distinction between the sort of learning that I talk about and the sort of learning that a lot of even promoters of online learning talk about. There's the quote here on the slide. This quote is from a report that was released today by the Canadian Council on Learning. It's buried in it somewhere. The development of our greatest asset, the potential of our people. And that quote, when I read it, and they're talking about the need for lifelong learning. We need lifelong learning for the development of our greatest asset. And they go on to talk about the economy. And it's like it slapped me in the face because people aren't assets. There's this us versus them. There's this us owning them. There's this us having them as a resource attitude to learning that was expressed here. And, it's, to me, so archaic and so contrary to the idea of a free and democratic society where people really are like property that will be raised and educated and then put to work in the factories or whatever, you know, doing whatever they need to do in order to generate that good economy. That's not the purpose of learning. That's not why people learn. People don't go to school. People don't go to university in order to be assets to the economy. Nobody is motivated by that. And so we have a completely wrong understanding of learning if that's the idea of learning that we have. Now, we do not have in our society nearly the sort of visioning that allows people or that persuades people to see the fulfillment of their individual sort of excellence as the highest goal. Rather, the values in our society are more based on mass and hoarding, becoming wealthy, becoming famous, getting lots of hits. So part of the philosophy of open educational resource, and we'll see this very clearly as we go on, is this part of not valuing individual excellence. Sorry, I've got that backwards, right? The OER philosophy is inherently based in the idea of valuing individual excellence. And the philosophy that does not value individual excellence, the philosophy that is based on amassing, hoarding, wealth, fame, etc., is the philosophy that is opposed to open educational resources. We're going to see this running through as a theme, running throughout this. Next slide, next phrase. Without social or financial encumbrance. Education and social equity go hand in hand. I didn't have room for the nice, neat little picture that I ran in the newsletter the other day. But poverty, education, poverty. The two are inextricably inversely related. High poverty means low education. Low education means high poverty. Now, that's important, and it's important in a couple of ways. First of all, it tells us you don't get out of poverty without education, but you don't get education without getting out of poverty. These are mutually dependent variables. Because these are mutually dependent variables, a simple causal type of linear causation type of approach isn't going to work. You don't solve the problem of education just by throwing money at poor people, but you don't solve the problem of poor people just by throwing education at them. So it's more, I don't want to say organic because that's not really the word I mean, but it's more complex than that. And to add to that, and the reason why I said without social or financial encumbrance is that financial encumbrance is only one of the barriers to learning. It's certainly not the only barrier. There is a host of social pressures contrary to learning, not the least of which is the pressure to conform, the pressure to imitate, to duplicate, rather than to achieve. The link there was this big fuss in the U.S. recently about the lesbian couple that wanted to go to the prom, and of course they were barred from going to the prom, but then that was overturned and they set up their own prom, but then only a few people attended. So that's what I was looking for, but I found this article instead, where a lesbian student was fooled into going to a fake prom that had only 7 people in it, including several mentally challenged people and some handicapped people, etc. And it's like, this idea that, you know, difference is to be punished, conformity is the objective, that is a value that is taught through society and through school, and that, as much as poverty, is a barrier to individual achievement and individual excellence. There's a whole element here where, it's hard to simply come at it with a straightforward approach because it's complex, but there's a whole area here where open educational resources and the whole production of open educational resources is tied in with the models and the way values are modeled in society. And in a society where creativity, where sharing, where expression are modeled and valued, these are the sorts of societies where you see a greater affinity for open educational resources. But the converse is true, right? You need your open educational resources in order to foster the values of creativity, expression, etc. So again, it's one of these complex relationships. So I continue on in that theme, where they may express themselves fully and without reservation. Expression is central to erete. Expression is central to the idea of achieving personal excellence. But I'm seeking more than just freedom, more than just the capacity or the legal right to express yourself. I'm seeking an environment in which it's safe, in which it's possible, in which it's expected, in which it's the norm. So that means removing the fear that people have from expressing themselves. It also means addressing the lack of capacity. Again, people learn to repeat, not to create. People learn to parrot back what they've been told, and we call that learning, rather than to create stuff that they haven't been told. So these are values that I believe come hand in hand with self-expression. Self-expression comes hand in hand with individual excellence, with individual value, and that is, to me, foundational, fundamental to a healthy and a thriving society. Next phrase. Through art, this is expression through art, writing, athletics, invention, or even through their avocations or lifestyle. You might wonder why I would take the time to go through a list like that. Why didn't I just say expression and stop? But as the first sub-point says there is not just one language of thought. And indeed, communication itself is not simply about describing or telling. This is a theme that I return to over and over and over when I'm talking about open educational resources. And there's a difference between creating a resource, a piece of text, whatever, in order to tell somebody something, in order to have some sort of semantic meaning to it, and creating a resource to use as an element of conversation itself. It's hard to explain what I mean. People who create these resources create what are in effect words in a conversation. And the exchange of these resources is the exchange of these words in a conversation. And so the resource is, it's not what the resource says, it's not what the content of the resource is that is important. It's how the resource is used, it's where and when the resource is shared, it's the way it contributes to this dialogue going back and forth. This dialogue going back and forth, we typically think of communication as the moving of an idea from one person to another, but that's not what happens. And that's why we don't have to use sentences, words, things that have semantical meaning. What we are trying to do when we communicate with people, and this is why I'm really happy I have Kurt's face here that I can see him reacting, and I can see not whether my words have meaning, but whether I am inducing thought. So I can do almost whatever I want, right? I can give Kurt some words, and maybe that'll induce some thought, or I can show him a little globe. Maybe that'll induce some thought. Or maybe I'll induce a different thought with pain pills. You know what I mean? And think about, you know, you couldn't even read the writing on that. It actually says cold medication, but I made it be pain pills because you can do that. And the idea is, you know, not to get some sentence into his head, but to kind of stimulate some sort of internal experience that he has. And if I'm a good communicator, I can induce the kind of experience that I want, but you can't just induce it. It's not a strict causal kind of thing. You can't force it to happen, and it depends as much on Kurt as it does on me. This is what communication is, and this is what we are doing with all of the different activities in society. People always say to me, well, sports, why are you interested in sports? Sports is communication. Art is communication. Auto mechanics is communication. And if you don't believe me, go to a garage and look at the guys hanging out around the motor with beers and whatever. That's communication, but it's not communication in the form of words or even wrench movement. It's communication in a whole system of communication. And it's that kind of expressivity that I'm trying to get at when I'm talking about individual expressivity. That's why OERs are important, because all of these different ways we have of communicating, of conversing, of inducing thoughts in each other require more than just words. They require images, they require music, they require artifacts, and they require in us, and I'll hit this in the future, the ability to manipulate, remix, repurpose these things to create our own kind of artifacts. Where they are able to form networks of meaningful and rewarding relationships with their peers. These are very deliberately chosen words, which is I find interesting, because it would be another 3 or 4 years before I realized what I was up to when I said that sentence. But there's a distinction to be drawn between organization in the form of a network and organization in the form of a group. And again, this is very important when we're thinking about open educational resources. It's the idea of organization by connection as opposed to organization by mass. I'll come back to that idea. The presentation that I linked to there is the text from the talk that I gave in 2006 in Wellington called Groups versus Networks, The Class Struggle Continues. And in that talk, I talked about these two different ways of organizing society, of organizing ourselves. And what I find to be important is, even though there are roles for groups, even though there are roles for organizations that are based on identity and sameness, it is essential that we also have organizations that are based on exchange, that are based on connection, where identity and sameness are not the underlying values. And the idea here is to create networks where we have exchanges of mutual value. And this is a change in the power relation in an educational environment. I've put on the slide there, not teacher, student, not boss, employee. The idea of learning in an open network environment isn't one where there is a teacher and there is a learner. It is an environment in which there is one person and there is another person, and they're in a network of people and they're all communicating with each other. You might say to me right now, you might say something like, Stephen, you're crazy. Look at what was happening now. here you are teaching us and here we are learning. Isn't that exactly the opposite of what you talked about? Well, it would be if the entirety of our exchange throughout history consisted of me talking and you listening. I sincerely hope that that won't be the case. And I urge in pretty much everything I write that that not be the case. Right now, I'm talking. And the reason why I'm talking and talking at length is because I have a lengthy thing to talk about. I hope I'm not too lengthy, but Kurt will tell me if that's the case. It's okay to talk for half an hour, to talk for an hour, because sometimes we want to express complex thoughts. You know, and the idea that you could not possibly talk for that long is absurd. But at the end of that, I'll take my recording and I'll take my slides and I'll post them online. And then maybe if other people find them interesting, they will talk about them and they will talk for an hour or whatever. And I'll be in that other position. So it's the idea here that the relation between me and you right now is not a relation of authority. It's not a relation of teacher-student. It's not a relation of boss-employee. And how do we know that? I said this once and it was very upsetting to them at a conference in Manchester, because it was a conference all about collaboration. And I said, you know, what's really good about this conference and the reason why you're here is that you can get up and leave whenever you want. And that one thing in itself is what gives it its value, right? If they couldn't leave, the entire attitude changes. If I have a position of power over them, the entire attitude changes. It's the capacity of doing something else that makes it worthwhile. And it's interesting to think of learning when thought of that way as compared to learning thought of the way we do it now. And, you know, I had a dispute with Michael Feldstein earlier, I guess it was last week. And one of the things that tweaked me was this whole idea of mandatory English classes in community college. And I've been in mandatory English classes in community college, and nobody wants to be there, but they have to be there because they won't get their plumber's ticket otherwise. And, you know, it's that sort of thing. When we're in this position where we make things required and we're pushing people into something that they don't want to do, that's where a lot of the problems of communication happen, where a lot of the learning breaks down, and where all of a sudden you get into this great big need for motivation, etc. A lot of the people I talk to online are involved in corporate learning or military learning. Kurt, you might know a few people, and the same situation happens. And it, you know, it's, I remember at a conference in Fredericton, and they're going on about learner-centered corporate learning, and I'm scratching my head because I'm wondering, where is the learner choice in learner-centered corporate learning? It was an oxymoron, and it is an oxymoron. And it's something that corporations need to get a handle on, because, you know, they can talk all they want about learner-centeredness and personal empowerment and all of that, but in the end, they are dictatorships. And that stands in fundamental contradiction to whatever they may say about personal empowerment, etc., etc. And that's kind of a response to Thompson. I've forgotten his first name. I should know it.
Hey, Stephen, you did pause for a second and see whether or not people might at this point have a question, and I'll just raise that. Does anyone want to raise a question here? Justin's chiming in,
mm-hmm,
saying there could be an opportunity for professional development time being allowed.
Yeah. I don't want to jump all over Justin because I don't know him, but think about the meaning inherent even in the word, in the phrase, being allowed. You know, I mean, what kind of relationship does the one person have with the other when part of that relationship consists of something being allowed? I mean, if I tried to pull that with you on the street, you know, you'd laugh at me and maybe even hit me, you know? So I think if learning is ever going to work in a corporate environment, learning is going to have to be freed, which means corporations are going to have to take a different attitude toward learning. The 20% time, I think, is probably a better way of putting it. The 20% time, of course, is the reference to Google's 20%, where people can work on whatever they want. That's getting a lot closer to the sort of thing I mind, or that I mean. Imagine corporations saying, 20% learning time. We will pay you 20% of your time to learn whatever you want. Now, I don't know if there's any corporation ready to go there yet, although interestingly mine will, because they don't know of any way to stop it from happening. I suppose they could fire me. But you know what I mean? I think I was indoctrinated as a kid, because in grade 6 and grade 7, they had electives, and the electives were basically designed by the students. So I had, for about 40% of my school week, for a couple of semesters, basically the opportunity to study whatever I wanted. I learned a bunch of things. I learned Chinese cooking, which was great, and I still remember that to this day, and it serves me well. You might think that was wasted time, but it wasn't wasted time. I can feed myself. I learned Chinese history, which, all the dynasties and that, and, haven't memorized the dynasties, much to my regret, but I still found it very interesting, and, the important things there are the lessons about the different societies, the different ways of thinking. I learned that I am not a banker. How did I learn this? We had an economic simulation game, and they made me the banker. And, my bank failed. unfortunately, it was too big to fail, and that was the end of our economic simulation. Just completely and utterly failed. They set up two banks to set up competition. I wiped out the competition and then failed. And that was the end of it. and there's more, right? I look back on my own education. I was educated in a small town with young, ambitious teachers who didn't get jobs in the city and so had to go to the small country school and experiment. And they experimented on me. And what they produced was me, among others. I'm sort of the walking, talking instantiation of some of these things. Shall I continue, or should we see if there's more questions? Or no, alternatively, Kurt will just vanish from the screen. Oh, poor Kurt. He must be on AT&T. That was an unsponsored remark. All right. With people who share the same interests or hobbies. And I talk a lot about diversity, but this is the other side of it. This is the concept of homophily, or homophily, depending on how you pronounce it, associating with people like oneself, interested in the things that one is interested in. It's the idea of the community of practice, but the way I've phrased it here is very important. It's not about work. It's not about employment. It may be if work and employment happen to coincide with your interests and hobbies, but it's mostly about your interests and hobbies. And this is one of the foundations of networking, and without this, we don't get networking. It's called Hebbian associationism, and it's the idea that people with similar interests will form connections between each other. OER-based schools have begun popping up. Where do you see this trend going? I'll come back to that one, okay, Elliot? Don't let me forget that. Because I think I do know where that trend is going, and I'm kind of concerned, but I need to set up why I'm concerned. The same political or religious affiliations. Again, this is more homophily. I'm sure there's a right way to pronounce it, but I'm sure I can come up with many more. And what I want to emphasize here is that we each have multiple dimensions of being, multiple dimensions of self-identification. And I want to draw out the idea here that there are many legitimate ways for us to be part of a mass, as it were, that help define us. I tried to express that in a set of photo sets called Portraits of Montreal, and the link is there. And those also form a part of my paper, which I forgot to link there, My Digital Identity. And it's funny because I actually submitted my digital identity to a journal and it was rejected because it didn't have any references. Well, it had references, it just didn't have any references to the editors of the journal. But the other part of it is, you know, that was only half of my argument. The other half of my argument was composed in all of these photos, but I couldn't put all of these photos into a journal article. So I got this sort of kind of half there journal article. But the idea here is that through our identification of sameness with many different people, we each create our own mosaic of ways of being the same with other people. And so we're the same in value, we're the same in architectural styles, we're the same in enterprise, in business, we're the same in appearance, in race, in gender, in language, we're the same in vision of the world, in culture, in art, in religion, and the rest. And we're the same with other people in each of these ways, but by being the same with others in each of these ways, that creates in ourselves a form of individuality, a form of uniqueness. So, you know, sameness and diversity are not opposed. Sameness and diversity are not contradictories. They're not even contraries. We become diverse by being the same. I have a slogan that I used in my paper, My Canada, in diversity, harmony. And that's the model here, that we create our diversity through sameness, and we create our sameness through diversity. Or different interests or affiliations, as the case may be. And this is essential. Myself, Daniel Lemire, and Seb Paquette showed mathematically why diversity is necessary to creativity. And you see the reference to that paper there. The idea of bridging, of forming community of communities, the idea of diversity being the key argument against a broadcasting monoculture. I write pretty much all of what I write in short little 100 or 200 word essays in OL Daily. And I've been asked how to explain that. You know, why do I write like that instead of in a longer, more linear form, like a book, which I can publish and get 1,000 readers or whatever? And the way I've explained the structure of my work in OL Daily is that it's like a hologram. And think of, there's about 12,000 posts now. Think of those 12,000 posts as 12,000 individual points inhabiting a space, right? And it's a semantical space, so it has meaning and all of that. So, and there are themes and concepts that run throughout them when I'm expressing them here in this talk. And the thing is, when these posts are up there, these 12,000 posts in their individual, you know, they each have their own position in this three-dimensional space. When you look at them one way, you see one thing, but then if you move to the side and you look at them a different way, you see a different thing. It's the same stuff. It's the same post, the same meaning, the same semantics, but you see something different depending on your point of view. And that's very important because knowledge, creativity, intelligence, wisdom in society works that way too. Except instead of 12,000 individual posts, we have 12,000 individual people. And when you look at society one way, you see one thing. You look at society another way, you see another thing. And then all of the artifacts that we create together, again, fill a conceptual space in the same way, such that we look at it differently, you see one thing. We look at it differently, we see another thing. And the only way of getting to any kind of comprehensive understanding of what we're looking at is to have the capacity to look at this space from many perspectives, many points of view. It's not possible for one person to do, which is why you can't have one person expressing, say, the values or the meaning or the concept of a society. And it's not possible for a whole bunch of people standing in the same place to do, because then everybody sees the same thing and they miss everything else. You have to have a whole bunch of people looking at all of these points from different perspectives. And then from these different perspectives, each of them has a different point of view. And then the greater understanding, the understanding of the whole, is formed not simply from the perception, although the perception is essential, but then also from the communication that takes place between them. I, as a human being, can comprehend that this is a three-dimensional object because I can look at it from different perspectives, different points of views, and these points of views are all connected in my own brain, right? My view of this, like this, and like this is connected. And that's what you need to have happen in a society. So the idea of bridging, the idea of diversity of different of different concepts, again, and there you see a model of exactly what I'm talking about, where Kurt has a globe, another globe, and now we're going global here. And interestingly, his is still in the box, which means, I don't know what it means. Maybe it's electric. Well, now it's out of the box. I saw a wire on it, so I sort of wonder. It's a globe and a, what? I don't know. There's something on the bottom of it. it does look like it's electric.
That's just web-enabled.
It's web-enabled.
You can update your population, your... history, language, all this stuff on different countries and places. So, yeah, so the world's truly open when you have a web-enabled
globe. All his worlds are open. Yeah, I love it. Now, you see, if I hadn't done this, he never would have brought that. We never would have got the sentence, all his worlds are open. And that's how it works. This, to me, is a society where knowledge and learning are public goods. If knowledge and learning cannot be exchanged freely in this way, social discourse atrophies, society dies. That's a link to Alzheimer's. DRM is Alzheimer's of society. Is the Alzheimer's of society? I don't know if people don't like saying Alzheimer's anymore. They say Alzheimer now. But anyhow, and this isn't to disparage people of Alzheimer's. I think it's actually very serious. It's serious like DRM. If we prevent our messages, our communication, from being shared freely and openly with each other, our capacity as a society to think literally atrophies. And we become literally, not figuratively, but literally smaller, literally unable to remember. Literally, well, eventually dead. And that is where I fear sometimes that we are headed. And, you know, when I think about discourse in that way, and I think about discourse, you know, I think about using artifacts as words in a conversation. I think of the conversation as exchanging what we see from different points of view, different perspectives, and I see all of this as, you know, forming this common communication that we have with each other, and all of these artifacts as being the common property that we have created as a society over the years, everything from the color green to the letter A to the word mouse. You can see I was desperate there for a word. All of these are not individually owned, but they are a form of social property. And the great copyright debate that we have engaged in today is a debate about whether it is legitimate for certain private interests to appropriate a part of that common heritage, to enclose it, if you will, and perhaps by adding some of their own labor to it, declare it their own and charge us a toll for the use of it. I mentioned the color green. There's a company called British Petroleum who has a trademark on a certain shade of color green. There's a company called UPS that's trying to trademark the word brown. And I could go on, right? Walmart has attempted to trademark the smiley face. Coca-Cola trademarking the combination of red and white. The list is endless. I think somebody may have tried to charge me money for that chime that just played, right? It's appropriated, etc. I wrote a paper once called Copyright Ethics and Theft, and I pointed out that the amount of individual creative act that takes place in any act of creation is actually very minimal, and we quite literally do stand on the shoulders of giants. From the very letters that we use, to the words, to the turn of phrase, to the ideas, to the cultural surround, the actual amount of individuality contributed to any work is minuscule. And yet, they claim total ownership over that work. And they claim types of ownership over that work that they have never claimed historically before. So, you know, there's an issue here, not simply of whether it's ethical to share. There's an issue here not simply of whether we get better learning by sharing, but there's an issue here of fundamental ownership of our own culture and our own identity. This, to me, is a society where knowledge and learning are public goods, freely created and shared. And we talk a lot in open educational resources about open source and the four freedoms that Richard Stallman talks about: freedom to run, freedom to study, freedom to redistribute, and freedom to modify and reshape. But in my great debates with David Wiley, linked there at the bottom, I raise the issue, freedom from whose perspective? Because a lot of the discussion of freedom in open source, and especially in open education resources, is from the perspective of the person who has the resource. And they say, well, aren't you more free if you have the right to charge money for that resource? And I suppose in some kind of twisted sense you are. That's sort of like saying, yeah, you're more free if you're allowed to steal and claim things for your own. But my approach to open educational resources is from the perspective of the person who wants or needs access in order to, say, lift themselves out of poverty, and the demand for money is a barrier against my freedom to access. And this debate rages back and forth, right? But ultimately, what I notice, and I've discussed this at length with Dave, is that when you have free goods and commercial goods in the same space, and even when they're the same goods and it is the same space, the people who have the commercial goods will contrive a mechanism for ensuring that the free goods are no longer available, thus creating a market for the commercial goods. There are many ways that they do that. They seed fear, uncertainty, and doubt. They question the legality of using the free version. They question the quality of the free version. They create a regimen of standard specifications, quality assurance that makes it impossible to offer the free version. They charge tariffs for transporting the free version. They create a marketplace in which only the commercial version will be allowed. They flood the market with cheaply available commercial versions that make it uneconomical to produce the free version, and then when the free version stopped being created, they raised the rates for the commercial version. There's a whole range of things that they can do. Read Information Rules by Shapiro and Varian. There's an endless way of freezing free goods out of the market when there are commercial versions, even when they're the same goods, even when it's the same market. Walk into a bookstore and ask for their free copy of Moll Flanders. Moll Flanders was written in 1685. Copyright is long since expired. But you will never find a free version of Moll Flanders in the bookstore. Just, it's not allowed. You couldn't even go to the bookstore and offer free copies of it. They would kick you out. Anti-competitive, right? Wireless internet access. Try offering free wireless internet access in an American city and see how long you last before the lawsuits start, because you're being anti-competitive. Not hoarded or withheld in order to extract wealth or influence. In the discussion of networks and network economics over the last 5 years or so, there's been a lot of discussion of a thing called a power law. Let me explain what a power law is. When you have a network created by mechanism of preferential attachment, Anderson, Indiana has free citywide internet. Wonder if they've had lawsuits yet. I don't know. It may be that Anderson isn't large enough to attract lawsuits yet. Or it may be that the run of lawsuits over city internet has run its course. But I do know that there are still lawsuits happening, especially if any public money has gone into it. If no public money has gone into it, it's less likely that there are lawsuits. But if the city government has funded it in any way, then the city of government will be taken to court because they're engaging in uncompetitive practices. Power laws. Think of the internet. Imagine a graph where we graph individuals according to the number of connections that they have. Well, at one side of the graph, you'll see, I'm trying to get this right. Everything's backwards when you do it on camera. Here we go. So I can hardly do it. That's going to be backwards, isn't it? I don't know. That'll come out all right. So you have Google up here with like millions of connections. And then you have other sites like the Gawker sites, hundreds of thousands of links to them. Then you have people like me and Kurt with a few thousand, and then the vast majority of people with their friends and family linking to them. This is known as a power law. And the idea is, what happens is this, and it can be demonstrated mathematically and has been by people like Alfred Laszlo Barabasi, this happens when you have a random network with preferential attachment. And what that means is, preferential attachment is where you are more inclined to link to somebody who is already linked than to somebody who isn't. And so you can sort of see what happens, right? First person who gets in gets linked. Second person who comes in wants to link to the first person. Next person that comes in probably wants to link to the first person because they've got more links than the second person. Fourth person to come in, more likely to link to the first person, a bit less likely to link to the second person. You see what I mean? So you end up with a network with some people with millions of links and other people with one. Same model describes economic wealth. The rich get richer. It's exactly the same phenomenon. Amassing is described by power laws. Now the same sort of thing occurs with readership, publication, distribution, and broadcasting. If you consider broadcasting, broadcasters are at the big spike, right? They have millions of viewers. And then people in this broadcast, well, we've got, what do we got? We've got maybe 20 viewers, right? So we're in the long tail. I'm not manipulating that cat. That's hilarious. I hope you're recording the video of this. For those of you following the audio, Polly just walked by, tail right in the air in front of the video as I was talking about the long tail. Now, the work that I did with Seb Paquette and Daniel Amir and a lot of the other stuff that I've talked about argues against a logic of the big spike in the long tail and toward a more equitable distribution. And the reason why you want a more equitable distribution is because of this holographic reality that I talked about earlier. If you have broadcasters with millions of listeners, then one point of view is the point of view that carries today. And so you get a very narrow, typically biased, but that's just, who cares, right? It's a narrow perspective, misrepresentative of reality, because it is not capable of expressing, it's not capable of accessing and expressing that reality. If you want a communications network to be more expressive of reality, then what you require is, as David Weinberger said, small pieces loosely joined. And you might think, okay, well, where's the proof for that? Well, let's design the internet, shall we? And let's design it so that it works best. Well, here's one way of doing it. Everybody logs on to one big server, and we'll put all the content on that one big server, and then that'll be our internet. And that'll be really good because, you know, we can actually validate all the content on the server. Now, would you want an internet like that? We actually tried that. It was called, well, first it was called CompuServe, then it was called America Online. It was, in fact, a model that proved to be unstable and expensive. Compare that to the model of the internet where many people connect to many people. We have something that physically is much more robust, the old story of it being designed to survive a nuclear war, etc. But conceptually or semantically, it's also much more robust. We've seen in the last 10 years a blossoming of ideas, a blossoming of opinion and points of view that would never, ever have been possible in a broadcast environment. Now, of course, right off the bat, we are told this is a bad thing because views that could never be expressed in a broadcast environment, like pornography and spam, get expressed. Yes, those are bad things, but they are balanced in overwhelming numbers by the many other things that could never be expressed in a broadcast environment, like, say, this talk would never be broadcast, ever, not in a million years. They never let me on the air. They never have. I hope I'm not going too long. I'm getting there.
Stephen.
Okay.
And, but we maybe should check for a second, see if anyone has a quick question before we wrap up some other points.
Yeah.
Any questions for Stephen?
And Polly the cat is available for questions too.
Elliot asks, OER schools.
Almost there. We're about two slides away. He's freezing.
Then take us to it.
All right. First of all, just to wrap up the one paragraph, this is more than an hour on one paragraph, this is what you call close reading. When I say this is what I aspire toward, this is what I work toward, fundamental to my work is that it's not just a theory. And I have tried, not always successfully, but I have tried to express this as a consistent body of actions and work, as well as theoretical theorizing. Never mind. And so you can see it theoretically, you can see it practically in some of the things that I work on, like RSS and other content syndication networks. And this is where the whole PLE, personal learning environment thing, comes in, which is not really covered in this talk. I'm sorry, Kurt. You can see it modeled on my website, my 12,000 individual posts, my holographic representation of educational technology. Or you can see it represented specifically as a form of learning in the massively open online course, Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, that George Siemens and I built. The same concepts, you take the Connectivism course, instead of having a standard broadcast model course where George and I are the authorities and we transmit and all of you are the receiving subjects and you receive, we set something up which is much more open, first of all. I don't want to say more democratic because we didn't have one vote in the entire course, thankfully, because that really, democracy is a form of mass anyways and not network. But the idea was that people expressed their own things, said their own things, made their own contributions in their own way, and then the facilitating role that we played was to link everything together to actually create or enable that network. And so there's the model in action again. Now, postscripts. I have, as I recall, three postscripts. Yes. And this is where we're going to get to OER schools. So, first of all, and you guys have read the paper Models of Sustainable Open Educational Resource. And, oh, I love Donna at the very end saying, what is an OER? That's funny. I'll refer you to the paper. Models, and there's the links on the next slide. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that's funny, Donna. That wasn't nice of me. But it is kind of, you know, after an hour and 9 minutes of talking about OERs, open educational resources, somebody asks what one is. And, you know, it's funny.
Stephen, she popped in from the airport. I think she missed the first half hour.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. That's all right. But it was still funny. Just because of the timing of it, more than anything else. It doesn't matter what an open educational resource is. An open educational resource is a word in a conversation we have among ourselves. And the word can take any form. It can be of any physical substance. It can be a globe. It can be a cat's tail. It doesn't matter. Just needed to know what the letter stood for. Good enough. All right. In a lot of the discussions of open educational resources, we've seen a lot of emphasis on OER producers. And not just the universities. We see the foundations funding private companies and publishers and all of that. And there's a lot of desire on the part of many, though not all, of these producers. I say not all because MIT isn't one of them, but to allow commercial use. So what do I think is happening is that a good part of the OER movement, or more accurately, a good part of the push or the activity around funding mechanisms for open educational resources consists of publishers or publishing companies or distributors or other interested parties looking for subsidies for the production of these resources for free. And so the model will be, they get paid to produce these resources. They produce these resources, they're free, but then they can also be made available commercially. So now you have that environment where you have the commercial resource and the free resource. And when you have that environment, remember, they next get rid of the free resource. And so what you have is they've managed to get people to pay for the production of the resource that they are now selling. So it's a way of, you know, reducing your inventory cost. And again, if you don't think that will happen, look for free material. Is there free material available yet on the Kindle? I don't think there is. I think you have one. That's why I'm asking you.
I don't have a Kindle, but there are thousands of books that are e-books for the Kindle. In fact, 16 of the top 25 selling books are free books.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting conundrum.
Because I know I wanted to offer my blog free on a Kindle, and there was no way to do it. I know that there are free books on the iPad, but I also think that this is a temporary thing, right? I think that when everybody's accessing books on a Kindle or on an iPad, instead of, say, on that horrible, messy, open thing we call the web, then there won't be free books anymore. And we'll sort of see them slowly but surely get marginalized. And you know, once they establish the market, once they get that marketplace, then they will push the free content off. And Justin's saying we still pay with advertisements. Yes, but the model they want is for us to pay with advertisements and pay for the content as well. That's what they do in movie theaters, right?
So, Stephen, here's the email I got today from the Global Text Project. I'm going to post it in the chat window. Everyone can take a look.
Okay. Supports EPUB.
So basically what they're saying is that the Global Text Project, which is creating free books for third world countries, just published their first one for the iPad today.
Okay.
Interesting side point.
That is interesting. Yeah.
Rick is Rick Watson down in Georgia, who's the head of the Global Text Project.
Did they do anything for in the way of putting books on one laptop per child computers?
They didn't, and they haven't talked about that actually.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, given that they're also working with developing countries, right?
Yeah. Well, that's just it. But developing countries are very interesting, and you see a lot of this. I get a lot of mail from or around publishers that are based in Africa, and they want to be able to offer commercial versions of work, because what they do is they print them out and they sell them, right? And so what this has the effect of doing is making stuff that is free here cost money in Africa. And then that creates an industry which has an incentive to block the development of a free internet in Africa, where it is needed most. And that, in fact, is what has happened. And you know, it's the same thing when we talk about, you know, how will people in developing nations access online learning? And we hear over and over again, well, they'll access it on their phones. And there's a whole World Bank push behind accessing open resources on phones. But you ask, well, is it that, you know, mobile phone access is cheap in Africa? Well, I looked it up, and it's actually about the same in Africa as it is in Canada. But it's really expensive in Canada. I would never access content on a mobile phone here. I can't afford it. I access it on the internet, where it's, you know, just my regular internet, cable internet broadband provider. So what's going on? Like, why are people promoting the use of mobile phones in Africa? Well, because if you promote the use of mobile phones in Africa, then you're not promoting the use of broadband internet. You keep the prices high. You know, and this is a general phenomenon where poor people pay more than rich people because poor people are not able to access the competition that rich people can access, and therefore are purchasing their goods and services in a closed market. And when it's a closed market, the prices go up. There are no providers. It's like poor people going to the most expensive doctor in the city because that's the only doctor that will treat them. It's like poor people have to live in expensive housing because that's the only housing that will accept welfare recipients. So that's the kind of model that we're seeing elements of in open educational resources, and it's a significant concern to me and underlies a lot of my objections to the commercialization of open educational resources. Yeah, I think every publisher in the world should sit down once a day and pray to thank Steve Jobs that he's saving the publishing industry with that, the iPad. Yep. Closed marketplace, right? That's the publisher's dream, is the closed marketplace. Moving on. Second postscript on the idea that OERs are not enough. And especially in the last week or so, there's been a lot of pushback on this idea, the idea that what open educational resources mean is that we just throw these resources out there and then they're supposed to magically produce an education. And some very good and well-meaning people are saying, well, wait a second, that's not going to work because it never has. Well, it actually has, but you know, not consistently or reliably. But that's not the model of open educational resources that I'm talking about, or that any of the people that are styled as edupunks are talking about. What we are talking about is this model of open educational resources where they are artifacts created by people in the process of having conversations with each other in the creation of this holographic knowledge that I was talking about. They are artifacts created and shared by people who are pursuing their own interests and goals and hobbies and affinities, attempting to achieve their own individual form of self-improvement and excellence. They are not resources that are created with the explicit purpose of teaching that will be delivered by educational institutions in a standard broadcast classroom model. If you think of open educational resources simply as a way of replicating, but at a much lower price, the publishing industry that supports existing classrooms and institutions, then you have a misapprehension of the role and potential value of open educational resources. I mean, they have to be conjoined with the capacity to freely access, open and understand, share and reuse. And if they're not, then they're not functioning as open educational resources. They're functioning as educational resources that are currently, but probably not permanently, available for free. Should you be seeing a slideshow now? Yes, you should be seeing slide number 17 of 18, and I'm just about to go to 18, and we'll see what happens. Last slide.
Stephen, let me just interrupt for a second.
Yeah.
So it's a couple of the people coming, I think, from China are having a little problems with the audio. I'm not sure if maybe putting your headset back on might help, but if you're recording this in a certain way, don't do it now. Don't change anything now.
Okay.
And Donna, we can send slides to anybody. If Steven sends to us, we can forward them to anyone if we get his okay. Do we have your okay to share?
Absolutely.
These?
Yeah. Do whatever you want with them.
Can you send these to me later on?
I've already emailed them to you.
Great. Thank you.
So, yeah, use them, abuse them, do whatever you want with them. Just don't charge people money for them because then they won't be open anymore. Or, more accurately, if you charge people money for them, allow them also to obtain them for free and then let them make the choice. Now that would be
so
free.
So I'll put my email up here. If anyone wants to send me an email, I'll forward you Stephen's slides.
Okay. And now, I'm just going to plug in my speaker. That's mostly for the people listening on audio. So if you're hearing only me and not Kurt, it's because my speakers are plugged in again. I'm trying to make the sound to people in China a bit better. Think about the idea of DIY, do it yourself. The whole purpose of open source, the whole purpose of, well, the whole hacker ethic, in fact, and I was going to put a link to the hacker ethic, isn't simply to create software. It isn't simply to create resources. It's to try to, as the saying goes, to scratch an itch, to in some way make something better, either themselves or the world or something. People who are creating open educational resources, at least the people that I know, and maybe the publishers are doing something different, but the people I know are not creating DIY universities. Why on earth would we recreate that? What we are creating is DIY people. People who are able to create themselves in their own interest according to their own values and their own personal form of excellence. Now, that is not Ayn Rand atomism or anything like that. I am talking about people who live in a community of interaction, of exchanges, of mutual value in a network of equals in an egalitarian and equitable society. Because if you don't have that, it doesn't work. The question was asked twice, very patiently. And I'm just trying to find the exact phrasing of the question. OER schools. So what would an OER school be? Well, a school is the old model, right? The school is the broadcast model. A school is a teacher in front and students receiving. A school is the creation of a mechanism of transferring content such that people will remember and replicate that content. A school, as people like Ivan Illich and Paulo Freire often said, is a mechanism for indoctrination and propaganda. It is certainly, by all evidence, not a locus of self-determination and empowerment. That's not universally true, but it's largely true. If the attempt is to use open educational resources in a school setting to create an OER school, I can predict the conflict of values, and I can predict the exact form that it will take, and it will take form around the authority and the credibility of the resources being created, because a school is an instrument in which there is an authoritarian perspective. And if you are using OERs in a school, then they must conform to that perspective. Now, I can say it, there are all kinds of ways of saying it in an extreme way, but I mean, if you look at how schools have responded to the open internet generally, you see a very clear instance of this, and they've responded to the open internet mostly by blocking it. And especially those sites or locations where people create their own content, their own expressions. We like to think that blocking of content exists only in certain regimes, but in fact, the blocking of content exists in pretty much every country around the world. It's just different content or in different places, but it still happens because we still live in this broadcast model. So I think you don't get the one without the other. You don't get a good system of open educational resources without an open form of learning, and you don't get an open form of learning without open educational resources. And the reason why I prefer the open learning and the open educational resources is because you don't get a knowing, growing, creative society unless the people in that society have the capacity to express themselves, to be creative, and to see the world from multiple points of view, multiple perspectives which they share. If, by contrast, in our schools, we foster that as a value, if in our media, and most importantly, in our own example, the way we conduct ourselves in the world, we foster that as a value, then we stand a very good chance of having a generation of students who have grown up experiencing a kind of expressive freedom that historically has never happened. And in having that freedom, they will have a much better chance of being able to address the many problems that face us today. And so, you know, I think of open educational resources not, you know, just as free content for poor people. I think of open educational resources as a fundamental ingredient for our global society to navigate its way through what are proving to be very difficult and challenging times. And on that note, especially given that Donna Shea is frozen, I'm sorry, Donna, I'll end the presentation part, and it's an hour and a half in. I don't know how much longer you want to go or how long this goes, Kurt, but I'm in your hands now.
It varies every week.
Okay.
And you're the third week in a row we've had a guest speaker. And last week was John Trexler from the University of Wolverhampton, who's a mobile expert. And he talked quite a bit about what's going on in Africa. So your points probably were well taken, what you were talking about there. We should scroll back to Lisa Yoder's question. It was a while back ago. And she says, along the lines of what publishers are charging... Okay, so she went back to the iPad, which you... But before that was another comment. Lisa Yoder said, I would like to know how you feel, Stephen, if traditional schools will survive personalized learning as available online and digitally. Let me repeat that. I would like to know how he feels about if traditional schools will survive personalized learning as available online and digitally. So in effect, if personalized learning becomes available in online formats or delivery mechanisms, will traditional schools continue to exist as they are?
Okay, I want to first draw a neat little distinction between personal learning and personalized learning. I think this is unique to me. If anybody else has done this, let me know. And the difference between personal learning and personalized learning is like the difference between chocolate cake and chocolatized cake. And what I mean by that, because like every great analogy in the world, it's not nearly self-evident. Personal learning is learning that originates with the person for the benefit of the person. Personalized learning is learning that did not originate and wasn't created for the benefit of the person, but has had some adaptation or change made to it in order to make it personal-like. So, you know, it's sort of like personal learning and personally, and that doesn't work, like chocolatey. You know, you listen to the advertisements and they talk about these chocolatey biscuits. And you're supposed to think they're chocolate biscuits. But they say chocolatey biscuits because they're not chocolate. They're like chocolate. They're something that was something very different, but with a few chemical reactions and brown dye number 4, it's chocolatey. Anyhow. So classrooms, and I make the distinction because traditional schools can probably survive personalized learning because you need a whole infrastructure to take learning and first build it and then localize it and then personalize it. You need a whole factory complex for that, which the school is admirable at. Personal learning, on the other hand, the schools won't survive. I think we are going to have personal learning. I think we're going to have it simply because we'll have the capacity to have it. And when we have the capacity to have it, it won't be acceptable not to have it except through, you know, some very repressive measures.
And Stephen, I'm going to interrupt for a second.
Yep.
A couple people can't hear you without the headset on again. See if you can try that again.
Yep. Okay.
You have your headset? Thank you.
All right. It's funny, eh, how in some cases people can hear me, in other cases people can't. It has everything to do with the propagation of sound waves and the placement of their microphone. If you tried to analyze it, you'd tear your hair out. But if you just plug in the headphones, it's okay. There's a lesson in that. I don't know what it is. And so I think, and the reason why schools won't survive personal learning is because they won't be necessary. The picture of personal learning that I'm describing involves, if you will, the embedding of a person in a network of peers where these peers are similar to them in some way. And where they, you know, as I described before, where they have this conversation with the artifacts, etc. And the idea is, and I've said it this way a number of times, people learn, for example, to become a physicist by joining the community of physicists at a young age and communicating with them and watching them, even more importantly, communicate with each other and do physicist-type things, and over time, gradually increase their participation, or if you will, reduce their participation gap, and become more and more integrated into this community of physicists. If people have the capacity of doing that, and they have the choice of doing that or going to a classroom where their role models are other five-year-olds, they will probably choose to, enter the community of physicists. So, and the schools in such an environment won't be necessary, but they will survive. They will survive because as long as there is inequality in society, there is a need for an environment for those who are wealthier to communicate with each other to form their own private networks. And so private schools certainly will continue to survive and probably to thrive. And the same at the university level, community colleges and state universities will become more and more online, more and more integrated into professional communities, but the Harvards and the MITs and the Stanfords will retrench, and more they will attract, if you will, the legacies in order to preserve that particular network of better off people. And that has an echo effect, right? Because the existence of Stanford, Harvard, and MIT creates the existence of Brown and Rice and other less prestigious but still prestigious institutes, which people also want to get into. So, you know, universities and schools have a continuing role as the fosterer of social connections, but they will have a declining role as fosterers of learning. And eventually, not long from now, within a few years, the rug will be pulled out under, well, in fact, it's already beginning to happen. The rug will be pulled out from under institutions that are deemed by the public to be social clubs for rich people. And you'll see, a lot of schools aren't going to survive the funding crunch of the next few years. A lot of schools are already being closed. A lot of educators are losing their jobs. As I said in today's newsletter, it is war out there. Teachers and schools are going to be cut dramatically, and people will have to adopt personal learning because it'll be their only option.
I think Meg had a question. Being extended to elementary levels.
Oops. Could personal learning extend into elementary levels? Absolutely. It's an interesting thing because, again, one of the things that people say is, they have had experience teaching first-year college students, and I've had that experience too. And they're horribly unprepared to manage their own learning, which is true, and I've seen it too. And it's because they never learned how to do it when they were young. the one of the articles that I referred to at the very beginning of this talk, Things You Really Need to Learn, was in fact intended to outline a curriculum for very young learners. And these young learners, if they acquire that curriculum, and forget that I said it that way for those of you who parse my words and look for contradictions and thematic and presuppositions, but if they acquire those capacities, then at a very young age, they ought to be able to engage in personal learning, particularly if presented with a rich informational environment. You know, look at what kids do now, and Kurt can talk about this probably more than I can, and certainly people like Clark Quinn and Clark Aldridge and James Paul G and all the rest of the people who talk about gaming and simulation and that. Children, very young children, learn very complex behaviors, very complex theoretical systems, and are able to engage in difficult behaviors and master a surprising number of diverse roles in these electronic environments. Everything from World of Warcraft to Civilization to Doom to Pokemon to you name it, right? And I haven't even touched on all the sports games and then all the other stuff, you know, the entire subculture that generations produce every generation, and this generation has produced online. So certainly I think they've demonstrated that they have the capacity, but that does require an infrastructure. It does require them to interact with more than just fantasy characters. It requires that they have the capacity to interact with reality in some way. But I think that's coming, but you know, I guess we get the games first and we get the reality later, I guess.
See, we got a triple question here. Min is saying the role of learning in K-12 is everything. Autonomous learners. And Daniel Craig from Korea is coming in, he's still a student here, but he says autonomy is a sliding slide, isn't it? Well, and Salim adds, what about the workplace and all this personal learning? You know? So, any comments about autonomy being a sliding slide?
Sliding scale. I'm not sure I know what that means, although I guess the suggestion is you're never totally autonomous. Yeah, a sliding scale still doesn't really clarify it. I mean, I kind of get it, and I kind of don't get it. Like, life is quantum. Bye, Donna. Have a good flight. Okay. There probably won't be much more recording, Donna. Anyhow, life is quantum. And by that, what I mean is that it's composed of discrete elements. There's very little of life that is analog. You know, we have separate actions. We have separate things that we do. Separate decisions that we make. There isn't, you know, some one long decision that occupies us for 10 minutes. It's a whole series of individual decisions. And we can analyze that if we want. And some philosophers do. And they make for very boring and dry reading. But the point is that for any decision, you're either autonomous or you're not. Right? Because you're either able to make that decision or you're not. There isn't a middle point. So the only meaning that autonomy is on a sliding scale can have is that there is a range of some decisions that you have and other decisions that you do not. Now, if you express it like that, then it becomes kind of trivial, because everybody in the world is that way. Everybody in the world is in a position such that sometimes they can make the decision, sometimes the decision is made for them. So really, what matters aren't whether or not you can make decisions, but whether or not you can make the important decisions. Because most decisions that you make in your life, really, who cares, right? Did you have chocolate or vanilla this morning? In the big scheme of things, you know, it makes for good talk radio if you were denied that choice. And a talk radio host would go ballistic, but really it didn't make a big difference in your life. Yes, Min, each decision is a quantum event. Each decision is an entity on its own such that there can only be two states. Either you can make the decision or you can't, because it is a quantum event. It's like, do you walk to the left or the right? Either you can make that call or you can't. You can't half make that decision. It's either your choice to make or it isn't. So the question now is, when we're talking about autonomy, any meaningful definition of autonomy is going to include some elements along the lines of you make the important decisions for yourself based on your own needs, interests, and values, and according to a decision-making calculus of your own choosing. Don't make that a definition. I say that in case, if anybody ever transcribes this and then people read this and then somebody will want to say, well, and he describes or he defines autonomy. No, it's not a definition. It's just a description and a loose one. But you get the idea. And yes. Yeah, you didn't read that on my site, so I don't know what the reference to that will be. It's an interesting observation. They are not the same, obviously. I suppose you can be empowered without being autonomous. That would raise the question of whether you are actually empowered, because being empowered has something to do with you actually making your own decisions, at least certainly in the way I think of it. You could be autonomous without being empowered, which means you're allowed to make the decision for yourself, you're just not capable of it. I think each is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the other. I can conceive conceptually of empowerment without autonomy, but practically speaking, it's like, yes, you can have a horse without legs, but who cares? It's not going to have a practical bearing on us. A person who does not have autonomy probably also isn't empowered, because to be empowered is to, as I tried to outline at the beginning of the talk, excel in your own virtues. But if you don't have autonomy, then you find yourself attempting to excel in somebody else's virtues, and you simply don't have the same capacity. Mm-hmm. All right.
Can personal learning extend
into
the
workplace? Yeah. Well, and I mentioned earlier about the contradiction between learner-centered workplace learning. I mean, there's two ways of looking at workplace learning. One is learning that happens at work. And certainly personal learning can happen at work, because what you do is while you're at work, you learn. And this is something I actually encourage. And one of the links that I linked to earlier on, I'm not sure where it was It was one of the presentations. Oh, I'm not going to find it. But it is one of the links on how to support your own personal learning. And it was about using guerrilla tactics in the workplace to support your personal learning. Because everybody talks to teachers about how to teach and get other people to learn. And my approach in talking to teachers is to talk to teachers and about how to get themselves to learn and how to create your own learning network in the workplace that will serve your own interests. The other way of learning in the workplace, of course, is for the employers to have learning that they want you to do to meet corporate objectives, to add to the bottom line, to produce a return on investment, because there must be a return on investment, and therefore you have some kind of work learning program. If your work is structured in such a way that your relation with your employers and the people that you work with is one of an exchange of mutual value, then they can present the possibility of certain workplace learning to you, and you can decide freely whether or not to accept it as a means of exchanging this value. But if you're in a power relationship where they say, you will learn this, then you do not have an opportunity to have personal learning because you haven't had the chance to define when, where, how, and what you are going to learn. So there are conditions under which it's possible, but there are conditions which are more prevalent in which it's not.
Educational blogging, as you know, and you're one of the articles, your writings among the articles we're reading. Can you make any links to what you've said today to the purpose of educational blogging and, you know, how it helps to personalize learning, create autonomy, and all these other things? Would you like to touch on anything related to blogging? You're a world-renowned blogger. Can you give us some stats about how many people read your blog, by the way, and how that's changed over the past decade, and how you've been able to, you know, track that and monitor that, and, you know, so forth and so on?
Okay, there's a bunch of things there. And that divides into two major areas. First, about educational blogging, and then about me as a blogger, which I've written in my notes as B blog. never mind. All right. With respect to educational blogging, there are two things. There's the article I wrote for EDUCAUSE Review, which is not linked in my slides. I'm sorry. There are two aspects to that. The first aspect to that is the area of creativity and expressiveness. And I find blogging, or for that matter, any creative activity, it doesn't have to be blogging, to be important, because when you create, you involve yourself in this conversation. And it is the involving yourself in this conversation that produces, or as I would prefer to say these days, having just written on it, induces new ideas, new understandings, new learning in you. You learn better by blogging than by simply sitting there listening. You learn better by creating than simply sitting there listening. And I have a whole diatribe about note-taking along those lines. It's the same sort of thing, right? The whole point of taking notes isn't to have stuff you can read later. The whole point of taking notes is, in the very act of taking notes, you are learning. And so it's kind of interesting. It doesn't matter if you never go back to visit your notes again. They have still served a useful purpose in the taking of them. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, and I talked about that quite a bit in the educational blogging article, is the public performance aspect of it. And in that article, I talked about two grade 5 kids from the Institut Saint-Joseph in Quebec City who went downtown with the rest of the class and attended a circus. And then they blogged about the circus, and they, you know, wrote their reactions and what they saw and what they liked and what they didn't like. And a few days go by, and then someone from the circus responded. And you just imagine the reaction, because you know they're very young, this hasn't happened before. You imagine their reaction when someone from the circus responded. And this is the other side of it. This is the connecting and communicating part. And you know, you don't get a sense that there are other perspectives, other ways of seeing things, much less understand them, until this communication happens. So if you simply write stuff and then put it in a drawer, okay, you've learned stuff. But if you write stuff and you put it online and you get a reaction, you learn even more, because you see, or you begin to see, all the different ways of seeing the same thing that you saw. So in the article, I talked about this as significantly motivating, and it is. People, you know, when people realize their writing is going to be published or posted online, they suddenly pay a lot more attention to their writing, which is one of the major reasons why people don't want their writing posted online, because it's a lot easier if nobody reads it. But the other side of it is just this capacity for communication, for people to react to their ideas that happens, and that you know, these connections that actually do take place, not every time but frequently, that creates this new kind of learning that wasn't possible before. Kid saw circuses in a whole different way that he could never ever have seen without that communication. You know, you could take the kid in there and have them talk to the circus people. But again, think about what that would look like, right? It would be circus people talking and the kid listening. But when the kid blogged and they responded, it was the kid that was in charge and they who were responding. Total flipping of traditional power relations, total flipping of communication channels. So it's very interesting. What about not blogging but doing lots of responding, says Min. Same thing. You know, somebody who hits the blogs and comments all over the place, they're engaged in basically the same activity. It's a bit less public because there isn't a place where people can find you. But, you know, eventually they know who you are. So a lot of the same elements. So I think it's kind of like blogging light. The me blog thing, which was the second part of the question, more lurkerish. Yeah, a little more lurkerish. People who don't comment at all are most lurkerish. I think Kurt exaggerates when he says I'm a famous blogger. I'm not that famous. He asked about statistics, and I don't track statistics that much. And you might think, well, that's odd, right? Because, you know, it's, aren't you supposed to? But, you know, it goes back to what are my values and instantiating the values and conducting my practice in a way that's consistent with the values. Mass is not something I value. If I get a lot of readers and a lot of links, or a few readers and a few links, it's all the same to me. And really, it's better if I don't become famous and I don't become widely linked. There's a Venn diagram. Okay, I haven't seen that. But that's kind of funny. Maybe I'm the big round circle. Never mind. Do you know what I mean? I prefer to work in an environment where if I have an influence, the way that this influence is manifest is that I link to and talk about and work with a bunch of people, and then they themselves are able to have their own sphere of influence and their own links and the bunch of people that they talk to, and have the ideas spread, maybe, you know, have the communications web spread. So I haven't tried to increase my readership. The things that I would need to do in order to increase my readership, I'm not willing to do. And this is your broadcaster versus network trade-off, right? when you become a broadcaster, you have to see the world from a narrower and narrower point of view, but also at a more and more simplistic point of view, because you need to be accessible to more and more people. I can be really complex if I want, and it's okay. And I don't worry about losing readers or listeners or anything because I'm really complex, because that's not what I'm attempting to do. What I'm attempting to do is to work around and understand a certain set of ideas. And if I'm complex one day and simple the next, and brilliant one day and really stupid the next, that's fine. I don't need to worry if I'm not worried about getting a lot of readers and links. I don't need to worry about being perfect and polished all the time. I can be more honest in my presentation, and to me, that means that I become a better model, because people see what it takes in order to become good at anything, assuming I am good at things, right? People see the mistakes, the missteps, the backslides, the contradictions, the uncertainties, the errors, the experiments that failed, and they begin to realize that becoming accomplished is not a matter of magic. Becoming accomplished or expert is not a matter of good genes or being lucky. It's a matter of configuring your relationship with the world in a certain way and conducting yourself in certain ways, and then working really hard for a period of time. And then that will get you the best that your environment is able to sustain at that point in time. And, you know, there are a lot of things outside your control that you can't manage either, that you can't control either. And these are all factors as well. Sorry, am I rambling? Yeah. Okay.
Through podcasts and other things. So Yayoi says she gets your letters every day and looks for them with bated breath just to get them, and it's kind of ironic that here we've got the next week's guest speaker who's reading your work, and who knows how this all cycles around. So that's one thing you might comment.
Oh, and Kurt has frozen again, and I assume he's going to drop off the connection here, so I'll pick up where he left off. I'm not sure what I want to say. It's nice that she reads the blog, or the newsletter. It's a tangled web we weave when we blog. I mean, I read a lot of people, and a lot of people read me, but in the greater scheme of things, you know, as a percentage of the 7 billion people on the planet, it's very small both ways. And that's all it could ever be unless I attempted to assume much more power and influence than really is my due or is anyone's due. And again, I would have to sacrifice too much of myself in order to do that. And the flip side of that reasoning is, and I think this is important, the people who do have that influence have sacrificed that element of themselves. You have to be a certain sort of person to amass great wealth. You have to be a certain sort of person to amass great fame or great power. And so I think that, you know, while there's an element of our media environment that leads us to, in some way, admire these people, I think that if we have a good understanding of how communication works and how networks work, then we should also see that we should be very cautious regarding people who have great fame, great wealth, or great influence, because they may have a great deal, but it's going to be very narrowly focused, which is why you see politicians and athletes and others who are touted as role models being found to be in many ways very small-minded or very small people, because you know you may be an expert at amassing wealth, but you're therefore not an expert at anything else. Although we dangerously allow such people to have a great deal of say and control over society. I'm still waiting for Kurt to come back. I'm sure he's going to come back very shortly. But let's see. And so I'm just going to fill in time till he comes back. And I know we're losing guests here, which is okay because it is getting kind of late. Actually, we're not losing. It's kind of interesting on the display. The list doesn't get shorter, it's just gaps appear in it, which is a very interesting thing. What else have we got? Meanwhile, can you introduce what I am doing currently? Absolutely. My big project right now is called Personal Learning Environments, and I'm working with a team of people to produce something called PLEARN. PLEARN is a set of applications that are intended to support personal learning, where personal learning is as I've described it so far. And the major model for PLEARN is a mechanism that allows you to aggregate content, resources, communications, artifacts, etc. from around the internet, remix these artifacts, repurpose them, in other words, edit them, use them to create your own artifacts, and then feed these forward. The idea is that PLEARN will put you into a network of people with whom you have some affinity or another, and give you the most flexible way of creating with them. Aggregating with editing, yes, absolutely. The idea is you can bring content in and then change it however you want. Is it like an LMS? No. There are some features in common. For example, both PLEARN and an LMS are content management systems. But while an LMS is run by an institution or organization, PLEARN is individually owned, and you have your PLEARN and your neighbor has another PLEARN, and it's spelled PLEARN, right? Like PLEARN, only it's not pronounced PLEARN, it's pronounced PLEARN. Still waiting for Kurt to come back. So this is kind of interesting because we're continuing on. I don't know if I can end this session before Kurt comes back. There was somebody else who manages, right? Are they still online? You think I can end? I think that's what I'm going to do, because it's now after 10 my time and I do have to work tomorrow. I have long, PLEARN group meetings to do, and it's my last day in the office for a month, so it's got to be a good day. So, and I see Kurt has showed up in the screen, which means he may reappear in the window at any time. But thank you very much, those of you who managed to hold on to the end. This has been a very long recording, and I feel at times that I've wandered a bit. But on the other hand, I really appreciate, Kurt, you giving me the opportunity to get stuff off my chest, because it's been almost a month since I've presented and things build up. So thank you very much, and I appreciate that. And for anyone listening to the audio recording or still here, if you're still with me, you've just spent 2 hours and some, and so I really appreciate that. I know what 2 hours is worth, believe me, and so I really... really appreciate you taking the time to listen, and I do hope to hear from you or read about you at some time in the future. So Kurt, I'm going to turn the microphone and the table back to you, and I'm wrapping up for myself.
Sorry I got disconnected there. I appreciate everyone waiting for me to come back. My modems must be dying upstairs, or the router must be dying. So, Steve, if you could type your email in the chat window, if it's possible for people to contact you, or ways in which you might be contactable, if it's not through email, if there's another way, that'd be great. And, again, I've got the slides. If people want to write to me or to Stephen for the slides, you've got a couple ways to get a hold of him. You can also go to my blog post, which links to his blog as well as his personal site. 2 hours of Stephen's time is a lot to ask for, and so I do want to say a huge thank you to Stephen for coming in here tonight. And before he heads on a big traveling trip and his cat, too, I want to thank Stephen and his famous cat tonight for making an appearance, the long tail that it has. Show us that tail again.
I'm working on it.
Long tail. Okay. So, bravo, Elliot says, I'm in the long tail. Everyone's great. So, we are recording this. Stephen, I do have a question for you. How can people get the recording that you're doing? How would they be able to access it, and the recording that we're doing, Solim, how would people access that? So, Stephen, could you address it in the audio, and Solim, could you address it in the chat window?
Yeah, I take my audio recordings, and I take my slides, and I put them together in a presentation page, and then I make that available on my website. So I'm not going to do that tonight because I'm tired, but I'll do that tomorrow. And so the audio and the slides will be available at downs.ca. They'll be right at the top of the page sometime in the afternoon, early evening. So, and that's only because I'm tired. So give me a little bit of time to put them up. But then you can just take them, and the slides will also be on SlideShare, so they're really easy to use. So, or you can download them, do whatever you want with them. But, I mean, they're just text. They're not really great slides, but do whatever you want with them.
Next, Stephen, over the next couple weeks, where might people find you if they're in the same city as you? Where are you going to be?
Hiding? No, I'm just kidding. I've got, on Monday, I'm flying to Kitchener-Waterloo for meetings. And then I'm going to Helsinki. I've got a set of events in Finland that I'm doing between now and the 25th. And if you need to find out information, contact Timu Liomanen or any of the Flossy Posse people there. And I'm doing some unconferences in Helsinki. So if you're in Helsinki, or you're across the bay in Tallinn, or if you're from Russia and can make it up, those will be taking place. I'm not sure of the exact dates. I will post them in my newsletter, but they will be about 10 days from now. They'll be like the 20th or something like that of April. Then I fly back home for a day or so. And then depending exactly on when the flight is, I'm not sure when it is, I'm flying to Buenos Aires in Argentina, and I'll be at events in Buenos Aires. I'll be doing a symposium in Rosario, and I'm doing a couple of events in Cordoba. There's the Information Society conference that's taking place in Cordoba, and I'll be there for that. That's on the 27th and 28th of April, and then I'll be back in Cordoba on the 6th for another event. And I'll be at the book fair in Buenos Aires, even though I don't have a book. How's that? I'll be at the book fair because I have an introduction for a book. So I'll be there as well, and there'll be some presentation around that. And then I fly home and I sleep for a week.
Or less, because Yayoi and I are going to help run an unconference at Global Learn in Penang next month. The basics of an unconference and what that entails, and how a successful unconference is conducted, if it can be conducted.
Oh, well, an unconference, they can certainly be conducted. There's no question about it. The idea of an unconference is It's not organized ahead of time. The people who are there are the right people to be there. What they choose to do is the right thing to do, and the results are the right results. And basically the idea is the group assembles people who have something that they may be interested in talking about or sharing, place their suggestions on a large board. People then either choose to go to those presentations or discussions, or they choose to put their own up. And so basically people vote with their feet and form their own groups, and then those groups are self-organizing. They may be maybe something like this, where one person talks, or they may form a working group, or they may form a discussion. And yes, men, it's rampant autonomy. A variation on this is the EduCamp, and that's the whole camp model. And the camp model is a bit more formal, but not a lot more formal. I did EduCamps with Diego Leal in Colombia, and then he's been doing a series of those with people like Nancy White and Scott Leslie and a bunch of other people. They've been very successful there. They're a bit more organized in the sense that you seed the population with people who have some expertise, and you seed the environment with the technology that you want to talk about. So, you sort of plan ahead a little bit, but then the people arrive and you still let them make their own decisions, right? So you don't march them from station to station to station or anything like that. You have a bunch of stations set up. People go where they want. People still form their own groups. Groups can talk to a whole. The whole sometimes can talk to the group. So it's still pretty chaotic. And of course, it always works better if you have Latin music in the background, which all of the Colombian EduCamps did. So, and I see Kurt has frozen again. Oh, that's funny. Let's everybody pull together and buy Kurt a new hub. We'll buy him a hub for his birthday. I don't know when his birthday is. But yeah, the EduCamps and unconferences are excellent, and if you're doing it in Penang, you're also doing it in one of the world's truly beautiful places. I've never been there, but I've heard, and I've actually talked to people who are from there, so that's interesting to me. I'm not going to wait for Kurt this time. I'm going to wrap it up and head on out of here, because we're now 2 hours and 14 minutes, and I'm tired. So thank you, everyone. Really a pleasure talking to all of you. And, I recognize some names and I see some new names, but I know I'll be able to see you all online or in person sometime in the future again. And Kurt, if you're listening to this because you've fast-forwarded to the very end to see what you've missed, thank you. And I'll send you money for a hub. Bye, everyone.